Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Upcoming is Memorial Day this weekend. Originally, it was Decoration Day, set aside each May 30th for decorating with flowers the graves of soldiers and sailors who fell in the Civil War, according to Webster's University's dictionary. Then Cuba, 1898, the World Wars, Korea and Vietnam, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Each year, Americans try to remember the nation's war dead from all these wars. It's honest enough to think a moment, a day, a three-day weekend even, about war dead countrymen and women. War veterans never forget them. Their names, perhaps, their faces, but not their deaths, which haunt them eternally. Flowers are indeed placed on graves by families, friends, and lovers, who, though they grieve, are seldom prone to question the rightness of the loss. Dishonesty reigns over Memorial Day, however. It has always been a rallying point for war, however unusual it might seem for the specters of death to be a successful recruiter. This Memorial Day weekend, war pageantry will be out in full force. We will hear the country's important persons praise the war dead as examples of patriotic heroism, their contagious reverence extolling their mute co-conspirators will suggest that only such acts of sacrifice justify the lives of the able, red-blooded citizenry. Even now, amidst the forever wars that ignited as well as anointed this new millennium with ancient blood feuds, there is fervent agreement among the grievants who seldom question or resist, no matter how absurd or pointless the arguments for perpetual war. Every generation has been incapable or unwilling to arrest the dismal pattern of murder, terror, and horror each inflicts upon itself, and our own risks world holocaust because of a compulsive insistence that we are unable to reverse the homicidal penchant of our species. Our most cherished values serve as war cries to commit horror, and we embrace or submit to leaders who offer nightmares disguised as dream worlds. Once more, we believe we are on the periphery of a war and feel as helpless as the generations that awaited the certainty of the world wars. Each modest gesture for peace is buried underneath official contempt and a weapons technology wildly out of control and virtually self-perpetuating beyond human supervision. And now, My Father's Wars by Margaret R. Frimuth. It is Memorial Day weekend. I am safe, protected. At least I feel safe and protected, surrounded by the environment I call home. I look forward to the long weekend because it allows more time for enjoying home, friends, and family, because I have an extra day to relax, not because I want to take time to feel remorse or guilt due to wartime repercussions. I check the listing of local weekend activities, parades, bugle corps presentations, more parades, and memorial services in local cemeteries. A Memorial Day holiday represents a ritual of coping with the memories of those who died during our various wars. Grief acted out through holiday, a startling contradiction. This weekend, I want to imagine myself safe and protected, don't we all? In truth, our nations build vestiges of warfare, pretending that defensive arms will create safety. I do not want to have to stare war in the face. I know it exists, but I don't want to deal with it directly. We trick ourselves into believing the myth of safety because it is simpler to fathom than the complicated truth of the many definitions of war acted out through violence. Ultimately, war has nothing to do with the amount of defense arms we have. War is a mindset that transforms the act of protecting into the socially acceptable act of power over others. War is the act of protection taken out of context and redefined as the right to be violent. Ultimately, we do stare war in the face, daily, unconsciously. The existence of war is a constant force in all our lives. War haunts our land and invades our environment. War slips into our homes disguised as entertainment on television shows and movies. War in the form of domestic violence interrupts relationships and destroys families. War attacks children in its forms of neglect and abuse. We as a nation observe presidents and politicians alike throwing around rationalizations for defensive actions and decisive attacks like they were volleyballs at a tournament. However, the end result is never a trophy. It hardly seems successful to win at war. I guess I have been spared personal grief because my family history is not filled with military deaths. Both my grandfather and father are veterans. They both survived the act of war, but its powerful imprint lives and is passed through my family today. My American-born, Danish-raised grandfather stole away from Denmark to return to America and become a World War I daredevil air fighter, a hero who narrowly escaped many plunging, fiery deaths. My grandfather fought to reclaim a brave heritage with hopes for eventual wealth in the land of the free. He was successful as an air fighter, but success and the all-American dream did not make him wealthy. His neighborhood grocery store, Creamery, with 30 flavors of ice cream, never outgrew Clinton, Iowa, although the idea has since proved plentiful for Baskin and Robbins. He believed that he deserved a good life because he had fought the good fight. He believed that risking his life while taking the lives of others would somehow equip him with the formula of notable success. My grandfather passed on his expectations of success and wealth to his youngest child and only son, my father. At age 18, my father was drafted. He curtailed his American dream of becoming a successful electrical engineer and went to Europe to fight in the war to end all wars and to be a hero like his dad. The stories my father tells of World War II delighted much of my childhood. He was a star basketball player on the Army team. He was the responsible money keeper for his buddies when they went to the European bars. He ate quarts of ice cream while his friends sucked down beer. He was granted a leave and traveled to Denmark to spend Christmas with our distant relatives. But on rarer occasions, my father explained how the war had changed his life. I grew to understand why he never saw heroism in fighting, why he never bought me toy guns, though I begged to be like all the other kids, why he uneventfully passed on his dusty, unused engineering tools to my youngest brother, why my grandfather cursed him for marrying a small-town minister's daughter, why he was cursed again for choosing a small church ministry rather than seeking business wealth. I remember the few occasions when Dad spoke different words about the war, how his face changed to reflect unspeakable pain, a cringe of memory as he quietly told of a post-war march towards a concentration camp, of smelling it before seeing it, of knowing the undisguised truth of war through the stench of burned bodies. War kills. It kills lives and dreams and hope and unity. What is freedom or safety as after such a toll? In simple actions and penetrating stories, my dad changed the family interpretation of war. He recognized the freedom that lay waiting in peace. My family heritage impacts me. I have two models of power to learn from. War teaches about power. Do I believe my grandfather's truth? My grandfather, whom I love because he was strong and tough, a survivor from the old country, an immigrant who dared to build a vision of an American dream. I loved my grandfather when he was alive and felt his presence when I stepped on Danish soil. Or do I look towards my dad and see his struggle with my beloved grandfather? My dad dared to give up, dared to be ridiculed, dared to be rejected. The paradox of power is that its strength is in change. We are neither safe nor protected. The unfortunate truth is that violence remains the simplest means to acquiring a desired end. I cannot help but believe that this simplicity is the matter that binds us, limits us. We falter in our quest to rise above destruction because we tolerate violence as a means to end war. By practicing war, we fall prey to it. Until we hold accountable any act of violation, whatever the reasons or justification, we will never be able to give up war, and we risk the possibility of peace. I am relaxing while Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 plays in the background, the rush of vibrato followed by flowing melodies, power and tranquility guides my thoughts. The music sets the tone for the Memorial Day weekend. Mental reflections, questions and contradictions. Grief is a natural part of life, as is joy. What remains unnatural is the pretense that we are unaffected by violence and therefore removed from accountability. Commemorating violence will never be acceptable if we truly desire peace. And that was My Father's Wars by Margaret Frimuth. She wrote this in 14 Memorial Days ago in 2005 for the North Coast Times-Eagle. She is director and originator of VOCA, Victory Over Child Abuse Camp, and a former director of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service, now Women's Resource Center. And now, something I wrote, "Do Dead Soldiers Have Souls?" And I start with a quote by Jim Josie. "When you're in a war, you're already dead." And Jim Josie was a Vietnam veteran who committed suicide on Thanksgiving Day, 1978. A 1937 British movie that intended the English public be prepared for a second war with Germany in the early 20th century, this time with Adolf Hitler's Nazi Third Reich, Fire Over England, about England's Elizabethan triumph over the Spanish Armada in the summer of 1588, conjectured a quote by a fictional Spanish grandee saying to his screen wife, "The whole trouble comes from treating your enemies like human beings. Can't you see they cease to be enemies? Think what that leads to. It's the end of patriotism. It's the end of war. It's the end of everything." Compare that rationale with Donald Trump's threat tweet, quote, "If Iran wants to fight, that will be the end of Iran." Or his intent to pardon American war criminals who murdered Iraqi citizens, or his promise to take out families of Muslim terrorists, or his claim that torture works. There is a possibility Trump might stage a grotesque commemoration of Memorial Day, according to the New York Times, by pardoning a whole slate of war criminals. Having no honor of his own, Trump is telling the troops, "Don't listen to your superiors. Ignore the rules of engagement. Feel free to commit atrocities in the expectation of a presidential pardon," Max Boot wrote in the Times. These blood-curdling threats, as Max Boot calls them, makes it manifest that chicken hawk draft dodgers should never be allowed to start wars or send soldiers into battle. Many comparisons are being made about a possible war with Iran and the wars with Iraq, in particular the post-9/11 invasion of Iraq by American armed forces in the spring of 2003. As it just might be with Iran, so it was with Iraq, regime change and weapons of mass destruction. The first war with Iraq, by Daddy Bush, was to remove its invading army from oil-rich Kuwait in 1990 and 91. The second Iraq war, by Bush Jr. and his rich Lou, Richard Cheney, was premised on the falsities of a connection with 9/11, which actually implicated our erstwhile ally and Bush family wealth partner, Saudi Arabia, and that it possessed those gremlin WMDs, and to remove a dictator while we were in country. The war in Iraq was as much about democracy as it was about oil, simply because the soldiers who fought the war were more or less persuaded that it was, however manipulated and deceived they were in that belief, and that it was in revenge for 9/11. The same case can be said about any war Memorial Day memorializes. The U.S. Civil War was about slavery because that was the essential reason the soldiers on both sides fought it, for and against, to abolish or preserve. World War I was to put an end to war because the soldiers who endured the worst hell on earth, which they also created for themselves, slaughtered each other by the millions for that fervent hope, which might have not been a so subjective basis for the fierce dual obliteration. World War II is eulogized as history's most titanic struggle between freedom, democracy, and abject totalitarianism, fascism. Each claimed history on its side. The Germans, however, conscripted, believed in the rightness of a thousand-year Reich, despite their detestation of Nazism. And the Japanese despised white colonial rule in Asia, although theirs was as arrogantly cruel. The wars in Korea and Vietnam were more subjective than their predecessors, so-called brushfire wars, to promote or prevent the spread of Cold War ideologies and to skirt nuclear annihilation while simultaneously risking it. As a result, both wars were inconclusive. Yet, at the heart of each, the combatants fought for beliefs latently instilled in them or fiercely denied them. And for the first time in their history, Vietnam and its fractious people became a whole nation. So, Iraq. The grunts on the ground most likely held on to liberation ideology until the long war itself killed it in action. At the very least, they hoped their great personal risks were worthwhile and that their leaders had literally kept the faith with them. Yet every day in Iraq and in Afghanistan, twin forever wars, the Americans and their allies faced an equal tenacity by a hardcore resistance determined to oust the invaders whom they regarded as infidel imperialists, as pernicious as the earlier medieval Christian crusaders of the previous apocalyptic millennium. Americans seem inclined to make war. The USA was, after all, started after a bloody revolution, but not be exposed or responsible for its consequences. Public support for the troops serves as a war cry that enforces their continuance at war rather than returning them home alive, and it serves to disparage their deaths when public display of their flag-draped coffins are criticized as debasing the honored dead. The Pentagon, which is notorious for dissembling the horrors it perpetrates, does not permit public display or access to the war dead, or for that matter, to the wounded of its wars who stream back to the USA like spring runoff. The policy, Pentagon spokespeople say, is to, quote, respect the privacy of the families of the dead. Yet the real purpose behind this banal sophistry might more truthfully be to protect, as Joyce Maynard wrote during the Iraq War, the delicate sensitivities of the ruling class as Americans die to build them an empire. Barbara Bush, the mother of Junior Bush, said at the time, "Why should we hear about body bags and deaths? It's not relevant to waste my beautiful mind on that." Almost from the time the Pentagon was built in 1943 at the height of World War II, the War Department, MARS, was given a name change as well as a sales pitch sanctity, refitting itself as the Defense Department, or Mother. And the more disingenuously it acted in the half-century Cold War that immediately succeeded World War II, the more necessary its contradictions required unctuous dissimulation. In recent wars, American war casualties have been manipulated to obscure their numbers, while inflated casualty tolls of an enemy are increasingly relied upon as the measurement of success. The Vietnam War was so dependent on exaggerated body counts that at least one study of the numbers estimated that the populations of both North and South Vietnam were eradicated by 1969. 6 years before the war ended in 1975. Even the body bags of American KIAs are euphemized. They are referred to as transport containers. Americans should not only be allowed to simply view the coffins of their war dead, but compelled to see the blasted, dismembered bodies inside the closed coffins to witness exactly what we continents, despite claims of righteousness, when we give free hand to make war, or at the very least, shift our collective eyes away from its personal consequences. And perhaps it would be even more pertinent for Americans to see also the dead our wars produce, such as the indiscriminate bombing of civilians in Saudi Arabia's air war in Yemen, aided and abetted by the USA, or American drone strikes in the Middle East that kill far more civilians than they do targeted terrorists. Display of the innocents American arms have killed would reflect Germans who were ordered by the Allies to view the masses of dead victims of liberated death camps at the end of World War II. Unlike the German people, who could claim no political rights or freedoms other than obedience to the state during the Nazi reign, Americans are constitutionally in charge of their governance and are responsible for its doings in their name, and are obliged to pressure their leaders rather than be coerced when they start acting Hitleresque, as does our current president and his cabal. An essential reason war is universally abhorred and cautiously perpetrated is the rise of mass media, which for all its faults has chronicled global aversion toward warfare by ordinary folk who suffer most from it. History records the lives and affairs of kings and generals, and of course their interminable wars. The hundreds of millions of common people impressed into wars and whose homes, towns, and occupations have been decimated by them have been ignored until only relatively recently, and primarily because early public media began linking their concerns and pandering to them to sell newspapers as well as advertising. The foremost purpose for armies is the destruction of human beings, despite claims of righteousness and deceptions of pageantry. Soldiering is raw and bloody-minded. Soldiering is also big business, the first order of every empire and polity, as it has since ancient times. But soldiers themselves are little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. Without soldiers, there would be no wars, no Caesars, no Napoleons, no Hitlers. Soldiers kill, rape, pillage, and burn, and if they are unlucky, stupid, or badly led, they die. Soldiers have been lied to throughout history. They have always been coerced in one manner or another to commit and suffer humanity's most hideous acts, generally in the names of its most sanctified beliefs. That has not changed. The Americans who are fighting and dying wherever in the world they are sent are as deceived as to the underlying purposes as were their predecessors of wars immemorial, and the rewards for such guileless intrepidity are as always unequal and usually disproportionate to the fervid sacrifice for them. Public support for the soldiers act contrarily as a relentless goad that pushes troops into irreversible horror at the same time that cheering war cries crush any who would conscientiously object. The soldiers feel compelled to carry out what they perceive as a public mandate, and in the belief that any personal doubts would be met with disapproval, they do their duty at whatever cost. Yet the soldiers we are exhorted to uncritically support can be turned against us, ordered to suppress dissent and round up political activists. In times like now, such repressive use of soldiers could have wide popular support. Quite a few people think dissent is improper once a war is started and refuse to believe it is more necessary than ever. Their point is that dissent succors an enemy and betrays American troops fighting the war. The war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent against their wars as sedition and disloyalty. But dissent is the true act of patriotism and a more sensible way to support the troops than dispatching them into horror. Yet, as realized by the Vietnam War, dissent is the only way to stop questionable wars. Dissenters are not responsible for the misuse of the lives of soldiers. The people who start wars are. May is National Military Appreciation Month, a low-scale agitprop that boilerplates the militant ministry of militarism. Its ironic yet fittingly tragic finale is commemoration of the heaps of war dead on Memorial Day at the end of May. This is Michael McCusker. I dedicate this Memorial Day program to a friend I was in Vietnam with 53 years ago, who is dying of old age in his own bed, which all of us who served with him fervently wished to do rather than be shipped stateside KIA in body bags. His name is Cliff McKenzie, a former USMC combat correspondent whose stories were featured in Stars and Stripes. And a final thought. Is it possible that Donald Trump is recruiting his own personal palace guard by pardoning war criminals? Let the silly season begin, but not war with Iran.